Hello, I'm Dave Dino, and this is Champions of Justice.
We are the champions, my friend.
This is the program that takes you behind the scenes with those who make the laws and those who protect your rights through the rule of law. Your hosts are attorney Thomas Girardi and attorney Howard Miller. Thomas Girardi is the founding partner of the law firm of Girardi & Keyes, known for passionate litigation of corporate giants on behalf of aggrieved individuals. He is a member of the California State Bar Trial Lawyer Hall of Fame and is widely regarded by his peers as one of the nation's top trial lawyers. Howard Miller is the immediate past president of the State Bar of California and a member of Girardi & Keyes, specializing in the areas of patent and other intellectual property litigation, antitrust, and general complex commercial litigation. They are champions of justice for the little guy. Each week we air this informative and entertaining hour, bringing clarity to the headline-generating legal challenges of the day. And today we have a murder mystery. Our guest is Steve Hodell, a former LAPD detective. He handled over 300 separate murder investigations and had one of the department's highest solved rates. He retired from the LAPD in 1986. Steve's first book, Black Dahlia Avenger, A Genius for Murder, was published in 2003. With new updated investigative chapters added to the HarperCollins paperback edition in 2004 and 2006. Black Dahlia Avenger is a New York Times bestseller, a New York Times most notable book, and was nominated by the Mystery Writers of America for an Edgar Award in the Best Fact Crime category. It investigates and purports to solve one of the most notorious and high-profile unsolved crimes of the 20th century, the 1947 brutal murder of 22-year-old Elizabeth Short. In 1947, California's infamous Black Dahlia murder inspired the largest manhunt in Los Angeles history. Despite an unprecedented allocation of money and manpower, police investigators failed to identify the psychopath responsible for the sadistic murder and mutilation. Decades later, Steve Hodell launched his own investigation into the grisly unsolved crime, and it led him to a shockingly unexpected perpetrator. Mr. Hodell's second book is even bolder in its subject matter and conclusion. In the book titled Most Evil, he discusses the shocking new revelations that have come to light since authoring Black Dahlia Avenger. With 24 years of experience investigating homicides, as we said, as an LAPD detective, he instinctively knew that if the perpetrator was capable of that level of cruelty, it probably did not begin or end with Black Dahlia. Mr. Hodell has devoted the last decade to examining the evidence of the killer's fascinating and mysterious life. His findings indicate that the person was among the most prolific serial killers in history, beginning as a young man and continuing to kill throughout his long life of 91 years. Among his crimes are dozens of unsolved murder cases stretching back 60 years. A brief history of Steve Hodell's life. Hodell Investigations was established in 1986. Steve Hodell has been a licensed California private investigator, conducting mainly criminal defense investigations for the past 23 years. He was born and raised in Los Angeles, served 4 years as a medic in the U.S. Navy, and joined the Los Angeles Police Department in 1963. After 6 years in uniform patrol, he transferred to Hollywood Division Detectives, where he worked all of the tables, burglary, robbery, auto theft, juvenile, crimes against persons, and then permanently was assigned to the homicide detail. During his career as a Hollywood homicide detective, Steve was promoted through the ranks to Detective 3, and that is the highest attainable rank in detectives. Mr. Hodell has said that the Black Dahlia murder was not a standalone crime. All Southern California law enforcement agencies, Los Angeles Police Department, Los Angeles Sheriff's Department, and the district attorney's investigators were aware and actively investigating at least five other murders as probably connected. Mr. Hodell has dubbed these the Los Angeles Lone Woman Murders. And according to Steve, all of these murders were committed by one man. Steve Hodell does not know how many murders were committed by this person. However, he believes that from 1943 to 1949, the killer committed somewhere between 7 and 20 serial murders in the Los Angeles and Southern California area. Mr. Hodell breaks down these suspected murders into separate categories: definites, probables, and possibles. And then to wrap up this introduction, in a letter included in Black Dahlia Avenger's original publication in 2003, one of LADA's, L-A-D-A's, most respected head deputy DAs, Stephen Kay, confirmed that in his opinion, at least two of these murders, Elizabeth Short, Black Dahlia, and Jean French, Red Lipstick, were solved. Head D.A. Kay went further, indicating that if the person was still alive and had all witnesses still been available, based on the evidence, he was confident that he would win the case in a jury trial. Tom?
Hi, everybody. Hey, thanks for joining us. And okay, Dave Dino, we've changed the course a little bit here. Steve, we've had Supreme Court justices on the show, members of the Supreme Court on the show, appellate justices, trial judges, lawyers who've done some great stuff. I think everything has been, all but one show has always been in the civil arena. But Dave Dino, this is the first time that we've gone into a much different aspect of the show.
We might call this the film noir version of Champions.
Yes, exactly. And I know a little bit about this guest. And the reason I know a little bit about him is because when I mentioned that we had a chance to get him on the show, Erica, my wife, who hit number one on the Billboard charts, Dave Dino, pretty good. Erica said to me, "Oh, Tom, I have both of his books. Very fascinating." Matter of fact, she says, "Don't you remember, I made you drive by some address, oh, several years ago, and I pointed out that that is the Black Dahlia." What, do you recall when that was? Where the address was?
Yes, it's 5121 Franklin Avenue. Are you talking about the location of the body, though, or
yes,
the house? Oh, the actual location was 39th and Norton, just south of Crenshaw.
Right, and then the house was...
in Hollywood.
In Hollywood on Franklin.
Right.
Yeah. So Erica was all over it. And while I have learned here over the past several days about our guest, somebody else beat me to the punch. But, okay, let's figure this out a little bit. Here you were, I guess we go back to 63, huh? And things had changed. It was gone from L.A. Confidential, and it was changing a bit at this period of time, right?
Very much so, Tom. The L.A. Confidential was very real back then, and it was part of my research and education about LAPD. Opened my eyes to how very corrupt the department was back in the 40s. I mean, it really was half the cops were on the take, and it was a lot of corruption, everything from theft to basically murder. And Parker came in 1950 and said, "We're turning this around and moving forward."
You know, obviously I remember the movie L.A. Confidential, and there was some truth in it, wasn't there?
There was a lot of truth in it. A lot of the detective portrayals in that at that time period in the early 50s were spot on.
Okay. Now then, here we are in the 60s. What motivated you to become a cop?
Well, that's a good question. Basically, I was just right out of the military, 4 years in the Navy. And I was working at a hospital. I was a hospital corpsman in the service, so what do? I was an orderly at Kaiser. And my new wife at the time said, "Look, you can do better than this, Steve." She said, "What about being a cop?" And I said, "Cop?" I said, "Oh, Dragnet, Joe Friday, that's cool." And that could work. So next thing you know, I'm taking the written and the psychological and the physical, and next thing you know, they're pinning a badge on me and saying, go to the Academy.
Dragnet was a very important show for Bill Parker. It really cemented what the LAPD was in the public consciousness.
Totally turned the image of LAPD around, absolutely.
Then you ended up in the Hollywood division sooner or later, huh?
Yeah, I worked basically back then in the early 60s. You were on rotation, so you did a year at each division. So I did West LA and Wilshire Division and Van Nuys. And I wound up at Hollywood Uniform, and then I worked that for a couple of years and kept bugging them, and finally got into detectives.
Suit, huh?
Got out of the uniform into a suit in 69.
What sort, did you have any formal training on murder investigations, or was this more all on the job sort of stuff?
Mostly it was on the job training. You know, you worked with senior partners, senior detectives who had worked for 20, 30 years solving murders. So, you know, your best information came from the old school guys who really knew what they were doing.
No DNA.
No DNA, no.
Man,
in fact,
that's been a curse of murderers, Dave Dino. That DNA, that can really screw up a good alibi.
It's a curse of murderers, and also had a great impact on prosecutors.
Right. Yeah. It's a little easier case.
The murder in this case, what was dubbed Black Dahlia, was so long ago, 1947. No possibility of any leftover DNA evidence.
Well, oh yes. Actually, there was lots of potential DNA that after I completed my investigation, I thought this would be solved quickly by DNA because of some of the MO and signatures that the killer did, as we'll get into when we tell the story. But there was a lot of potential for DNA.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, the DNA can last. There are DNA samples that have lasted hundreds and in some cases thousands of years. And one of the ways anthropologists can now track population migrations is through DNA that literally is thousands of years old.
Absolutely.
So as long as you have organic matter that contains the right molecule, no matter how old it is, you can use it to identify things.
We're going to pause at this point as you listen to Champions of Justice with Tom Girardi and Howard Miller. Our guest today, we have a murder mystery in front of us. He is an author, a private investigator, and a retired LAPD detective, Steve Hodell. I'm Dave Dino, and we'll be back with more right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Coming up on The Next Drive Home with Jillian Barbary and John Phillips, it's Monday. That means Donald Trump had two full days to start a feud with somebody else.
I love it. It's the Donald Trump one-man tour. Where can I get tickets?
Live and local, right here. After Dr. Drew and Psycho Mike, Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Hey, you like free stuff, right?
Yeah.
Well, KABC is on a mission to hook you up with tickets to the hottest concerts, comedy shows, movie premieres, theme parks, restaurants, gift cards, cash books, DVDs, hats, t-shirts, fans, cash money, Well, pretty much anything that we can get our hands on.
Gimme.
But before, hang on a second, you can get your hands on these cool prizes, there are a couple of rules.
KABC on-air contests are open to legal U.S. residents age 18 or older at the time of entry who reside in Los Angeles, Orange, San Bernardino, Riverside, or Ventura counties.
Employees of Cumulus Media Holdings Incorporated, its parent company, affiliates, related entities, and subsidiaries, other radio stations serving the listening area, and immediate family members and household members of all such employees are not eligible to participate.
Listeners may only win once every 30 days. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Limit one entry per person unless otherwise stated.
A complete copy of the rules can be obtained by visiting kabc.com/contest-rules.
Talk Radio, Talk Radio
790 KABC.
We're back with more of Champions of Justice. Our guest today, Steve Hodell, author, private investigator, and retired LAPD detective. Your hosts are Tom Girardi and Howard Miller. Howard?
Dave mentioned the passage of time. You start in 63. At that point, the Black Dahlia murder is already 16 years old. What is it about this unsolved crime? I mean, Los Angeles has had no lack of unsolved crimes over the years. What is it about this unsolved crime that has made it such a center of investigation and myth?
Well, and that's a very good point, Howard. The L.A.'s whole psyche is wrapped around this particular crime. It's, without a doubt, L.A.'s most infamous crime. And basically, as I see it, a number of things came together. First, you had a beautiful young woman who came out to Hollywood to be discovered, not an unusual story. Then on top of that, you had the absolute horror of the crime scene. A nude body posed, surgically bisected at the waist, posed on a waiting to be found. And then you had this name, the Black Dahlia, which came from some of her friends that knew her in Long Beach. There was a movie that came out called The Blue Dahlia in 1946 with Alan Ladd and Veronica Lake, and that was a spinoff on that. She would come in, this very beautiful dark black hair and a flower in her hair, and her close friends at the soda fountain in Long Beach called her the Black Dahlia, and after this film that had just come out that summer. And then, of course, the other big thing was the timing. This was 1947. This was the last big print story. Television was just about to take over, and this was literally headlines for 35 days, front page. It went viral and basically nationwide. And so all of those things came together to make an incredible mystery story that ultimately became far stranger. The truth became far stranger than any fiction.
Okay, I'm going to break. I'm not going to talk about the Black Dahlia anymore until I ask you another question. You had another very important case in which a person was convicted of murder, and you then proved he didn't do it.
Yes. That was another well-known L.A. case. After my retirement in 86, I became primarily a criminal defense investigator and had moved up to Bellingham, Washington, and was working up there and had become kind of the only game in town for criminal defense in Puget Sound area. And I got a call from an L.A. attorney, Gerson Horn, who specialized in criminal defense. And he said, I've got a guy down here that's in custody, or that they're investigating. They believe he's arrested for murder, and come on down, take a look at it. It might be a month or so. So I came down, and actually it turned into almost a five-year investigation off and on. And it was an amazing story, and it was two people had been arrested, a guy by the name of Miura, who probably maybe some of your listeners are familiar with, and Okubo was his supposed shooter partner on it. It was an L.A. case where Miura and his wife were walking downtown, and she was shot in the head. He had a superficial wound. In fact, he was just recently in the headlines. They were going to extradite him, and they actually did extradite him from Japan, and we're going to prosecute. But I wasn't representing Miura. I was representing Okubo, the supposed shooter. And he had been in custody for 5 years in Japan. And their system there is very different. They bring you out once a month, have a little testimony, put you back in custody. So he was literally on his fifth year of trial in custody when I started it. Basically, I started working the case, got a lot of evidence, put it all together, and basically was able to prove that he couldn't have been the shooter and he didn't do it. And he was found not guilty in Japan. Their conviction rate is 99.7%. So you've literally
got to... That's better than Cooley.
You've literally got to prove you're innocent in that case, and I did, and he was released. The other man was convicted.
Okay, I mean, just a couple more minutes on this, then I want to get back to the reason you're here. But what did you do to find out he wasn't the guy? What was the evidence you had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt in Japan that this guy wasn't it?
Well, basically, it was a situation where they didn't have enough evidence to file a case here in L.A., so they went to Japan, which is much more liberal, and they said, we'll go ahead and take it. And the whole thing on my guy, on Kubo, rested around the fact that he was supposedly driving a van at the time of the shooting, and they had some photographs that purported to be the van. Well, I was able to take those photographs and blow them up and get the actual antenna on the van, go back east and prove that antenna on the van was there, and the van they had, there was no antenna. So it basically came down to physical evidence and establishing that it wasn't the van, so he couldn't be the shooter.
Great stuff. Have you, I bet you've had a lot of these, huh, over the years? I mean, that's what you do, huh?
Well, yeah, and, you know, criminal defense, I mean, it's like you attorneys. You know, you go and you do prosecution for 20 years, then you go out and you do defense for 20 years. You really get both sides of the coin, and it's invaluable because you can, as a defense investigator, you can read between the lines and see what's true and what isn't oftentimes.
Okay, let's go back to Black. So
Fade to Black,
yeah. The Black Dahlia. So now you're out of the force. You have your own company, and you're doing investigative type of work. How did you get drawn into trying to find out who the murderer was of Black Dahlia? Many years after the event, after the entire L.A. Police Department, who focused on this thing for years, couldn't come up with anything.
Right. Well, I got a phone call, and it was from San Francisco, and it was my stepmother, June, and she informed me that my father had just had a heart attack. The paramedics were there, and he was pronounced dead at the scene, and she was hysterical and said, "You've got to come down." And basically, I jumped on the, a few hours later, I jumped on the next flight, flew down, and started basically helping out, putting together all the things that a son has to do in the passing of a father. And that led me into a twofold investigation. One into my father's background and mysterious life, which is a part of this important part of the whole narrative. And the second was some things that came to me that pointed towards the Black Dahlia.
Okay, so your father was, what sort of work did he do?
Well, my father was a medical doctor. He was a research scientist. He was a whole lot of things. And maybe if I can take a few minutes, I'll give a kind of a rundown on his life just to get a feel of it. Basically born in Los Angeles at Clara Barton Hospital at 5th and, Olive, where the Biltmore now is, 1907. At age 9, he becomes a child musical prodigy, playing the piano at the Shrine Auditorium, musically gifted, a genius with a huge potential for becoming a musical star. Then at 14, he graduates from South Pasadena High and enters Caltech at the age of 14. 186 IQ, one point above Einstein. Incidentally, that skips a generation. He then goes to Caltech.
Right, it didn't. The play off was no good at all, right?
Right. My sons are in good shape, but that.
Yeah, that's it. That's what they say. You know, one generation you skip, and then the sons come back.
Right.
Okay. Go ahead.
So he's going to Caltech as a young teenager. He's dating. He has an affair with a one of the faculty wives there. She gets pregnant. So after a year, he's asked to leave the college. He gets a job as a young reporter for the L.A. Record, which was one of the big newspapers in Los Angeles in the 20s. He's also driving cab at night out of the Biltmore in uniform. And he's one of his partners is a young guy going to law school by the name of William H. Parker, who will later become the chief of police of Los Angeles. So they're driving cabs together. He then does these kind of tabloid news stories. This is Prohibition, of course. 1925, 1926, and he's writing these kind of tabloid stories. He then leaves, and well, he starts double dating with a young man, friend of his by the name of John Huston, who will eventually become the famous film director. And he's dating a woman by the name of Dorothy, and Huston is dating a woman by the name of Emilia. Well, at some point, they switch, and John Huston falls in love with Dorothy, and they run off to Greenwich Village and get married. And George and Emilia look at each other and say, "I guess it's you and me." She gets pregnant. He goes north to Berkeley, where he goes to pre-med. 4 years there, and he goes across the bay, gets a job with the San Francisco Chronicle as a columnist, writing these stories for the Chronicle, going to medical school. In medical school, he has natural eye-hand coordination ability, and his professors are vying for him to be their assistant in surgery, highly skilled surgeon from the get-go. He then graduates. He has another affair with another woman, and a young child by the name of Tamar is born. So he's living with the two women. She has Duncan, the firstborn, and Tamar are living together. He decides he needs some space, so he goes off as a young doctor, becomes a surgeon for a logging camp in Arizona. He then moves on to the Hopi and Navajo Indian reservations, where he's doctoring to them. He then comes back to Los Angeles, joins the health department, quickly rises to the top to become LA's top venereal disease control officer, specializing in VD control. So this is about 1940. We're now into 1938-39.
Okay, so what you're telling us, he's just a typical guy.
Yeah, just your typical average Joe, you know.
We're going to pause again, catch our breath as you listen to what has to be for each and every one of us a fascinating murder mystery. You're listening to Champions of Justice with Tom Girardi and Howard Miller. Our guest today, an author, a private investigator, and retired LAPD detective, Steve Hodell. I'm Dave Dino, encouraging you to stick around. We've got a lot more in store right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
We've made a lot of changes to 790 KABC, all designed for your better listening. I'm Operations Director Drew Hayes, and with the additions of Dr. Drew and Psycho Mike, the new time for Jillian and John and for Peter Tilden, and more fun added to Doug and T-Ray in the morning, we put our best live and local foot forward. So let us know how we're doing. Call the KABC feedback phone, 310-840-2879, and let a rep, 310-840-2879. And thanks for listening to Live and Local 790 KABC.
I love KABC.
End of message.
What's RDO, you ask? Well, it's your soundtrack for good days and for bad. It's your party mix and your chill mix. Basically, RDO is the music app that puts your songs in your pocket. Find the perfect song whenever you want, or play free custom stations made for you. Download the RDO app free now and put your life to music. That's RDO. RDIO. Music tuned to you.
I'm Dan Smith from Private Plus Mortgage. It's a great time to refi because property values are up. That can open up more opportunities to save money, lower your payments, drop your PMI, and even help pay off those credit cards. Call Private Plus Mortgage today, 888-220-6200. 888-220-6200.
Private Bank of Buckhead, 3 Piedmont Center, Atlanta, Georgia, 30305. Actual terms may vary. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender, and MLS number 758195. Call toll-free for credit costs and terms.
Dear Smokey Bear, for teaching us how to prevent wildfires for 70 years, outdoor lovers everywhere want to give you a bear hug.
I want to give Smokey a bear hug for teaching me that a fire isn't out till it's cold.
For teaching me to douse my fire with water, stir the ashes, and douse it again.
For showing me that sparks from a dragon tow chain can start a wildfire.
For being a big fuzzy bear. I like big fuzzy bears.
Happy 70th, big guy. Let's bring it in for a bear hug. Come on.
Wish Smokey a happy birthday using hashtag Smokey Bear Hug. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service, your state foresters, and the Ad Council.
Get news, weather, sports, markets, and traffic first on the Fords.
Wow. It's actually kind of brilliant.
Only here.
KABC.
We are back with more of today's Champions of Justice. We're solving a murder mystery. Our guest today is retired LAPD detective Steve Hodell. He is also an author and a private investigator. Your hosts are Tom Girardi and Howard Miller. Tom?
We got the 187 working for us. We got the playing the musical instrument stuff. You got being he's a writer for the Chronicle. He's a doctor on the side. He's pretty much a lover about town, apparently, with one after the next, palling around with Houston. Yeah, so,
exactly.
So that's the situation.
Yeah. And then basically he buys, befitting his position as head of L.A. County Health Department, VD, he buys a Frank Lloyd Wright Jr. home on Franklin Avenue at the corner of Franklin and Normandy. Many of your listeners may have seen it. It's kind of a Mayan temple. It looks like a set right out of Hollywood. And so we all move in there. He comes back and he marries Dorothy, the same Dorothy that was married to John Houston. And she's now left after 7 years, left Houston, come back to Hollywood. They fall back in love. He marries her, and my older brother Michael is born in 39. I come along in 41. my twin and I, and then my younger brother in 42. So we all move into this Franklin Mayan temple type place in Hollywood, all kinds of interesting parties, all kinds of Hollywood film people, lots of the politicos of the day. And Dad opens up a venereal disease clinic in downtown Los Angeles at First and Central.
Okay, so now then we have this tragedy that takes place. He has a heart attack and dies, and so you get up there to try and help out.
Right. The last 10 years of his life, in 1990, he came back to San Francisco, settled in a high-rise on the 39th floor at downtown San Francisco on Bush Street. I see him on a regular basis. We become very close. He dies, and June, his wife, gives me a number of papers and stuff, and a small book, an album, a personal album of his, which had photographs of me and mother and some Man Ray photos, who was our family photographer, a surrealist. And also a picture of a young, beautiful, dark-haired woman with a flower in her hair. And I turned to June and said, "Who is this, June?" She said, "I don't know, somebody your father knew from a long time ago."
So now then, you decided that you would try to look into the Black Dahlia murder.
Right. Basically, I knew very little. I knew that it was an unsolved from years ago. I didn't even know her name, Elizabeth Short, at that time. So I start researching it. At that point, I'm divorced, and I'm still living in Washington, and I have my girlfriend in L.A. sending me up all the newspapers from the 40s. And there were basically three things that got me started in the investigation. The first, of course, was the photograph that looked like, resembled Elizabeth Short. The second was basically I discovered that a surgeon did the crime. They were very positive about that.
Why do you think a surgeon?
Well, because LAPD determined that early on in the investigation. They said this had to have been somebody skilled in surgery.
The body was mutilated when it was found.
Body was, and maybe we should spend a little description of the crime scene, but basically the body was carefully posed at the crime scene. It was nude. It was surgically bisected between the second and third lumbar vertebrae, which is the only place you can go without cutting any bone in half. So they knew early on that it was very likely that the person that did this had to have skill in surgery. So that was a big red light, blinking light for me. And the next was, and perhaps one of the most important, was the fact that I got my girlfriend set up headlines with basically that the killer decided to turn himself in, and he sent some taunting notes to the police. And one of these, written in handwriting, was "Turning myself in on February 29th, had my fun at the police, signed the Black Dahlia Avenger." So he's using this name in his signature. And
now wait a minute. So nobody turned themselves in, though?
Right? No. Ultimately, he changed his mind a few days later, but he was going to turn himself in. And he had been sent about a dozen notes to the police before this, cut and pasted, ransom type things, taunting the police. He even telephoned to talk to the city editor of the Herald Express, said, "You're some to be stuck. Maybe I can help you along." He called the police. So he did a lot of taunting for the first week or so after the murder.
But you're saying that there was one handwritten note from the killer?
Yes, there was one handwritten note from the killer that was undisguised. And that's why, and the police figured he really was going to turn himself in because the handwriting wasn't disguised.
Okay, but the police had all this information. They had the note, right?
Yes.
And yet, when this was a hot murder scene, et cetera, they knew a surgeon was probably involved in the murder itself. The fact of the matter is they never went further. Huh? They never put it together.
They actually did put it together later on, but not then, not for the in the first years. They didn't. It may have taken them about 3 years before they actually did come up with a prime suspect.
So you now start doing this investigation, and did you come up with an idea of who perhaps committed this unbelievable crime many years before?
Well, when I saw the front page handwriting that my girlfriend had sent me, I looked at it and I immediately recognized my father's handwriting.
Wow.
You know your parents' handwriting. I know my parents' handwriting.
Wait a minute. Time out. You know, people are going to turn this off. You're doing this investigation, and then here's this murder, a terrible, gruesome, terrible situation. The cops tried to do everything they could. They can't get anywhere. This is many years later. And now you've come to the conclusion that the murderer of the Black Dahlia was in fact your own father.
At that point, I never even dreamt that my father could have committed the crime. But what I did think was maybe he knew the killer. Maybe he's pretending. Why is he sending this stuff in? At that point, I thought there's something, you know, he's got to maybe know the killer. What's going on here?
But there is a nexus.
Oh, yes, there is a nexus. And basically, all that did was start me on those were the catalysts. I continue my investigation. Of course, I come down, relocate back to L.A., and I start investigating. And I spend the next 2 years putting the case together and discover a whole lot of things. And basically present that to Steve Kay, who was an active head DA at the time. He reviews it all and says, basically, case solved. There's enough here to prosecute and convict. With that, the book comes out, and that blasts open some secret files in the DA's office that are locked, had been locked away for 55, 57 years. And what we discover is that Dr. George Hill O'Dell was the actual prime suspect all along. They bugged our Franklin house, this Mayan temple, for 40 days. They have him admitting to the crime. They have him saying, supposing I did kill the Black Dahlia, we can't prove it now, my secretary's dead, which referred to the fact that she could have put him and Elizabeth Short together in earlier years before the murder, and other things. He goes on to talk about this is the best payoff between law enforcement agencies I've ever seen, on and on, very incriminating statements. So he's just about to be arrested by actually the DA's office. What had happened was, again, this gets back to L.A. and the corruption of the day. The 1949 grand jury was so upset with the way things were happening. There were a bunch of women, lone women murders occurring. They weren't being solved. So they actually ordered the Black Dahlia investigation taken away from LAPD and turned over to the DA's investigators. To my knowledge, this has never been done before or since. And so the DA, this Lieutenant Jemison, took charge of the case and actually put it together, basically coordinated the surveillance, electronic surveillance. They had two detectives sitting in the Hollywood station, the basement of Hollywood station, monitoring these recordings 24/7, team of 18, task force of 18. And they had all of this, and they were about to arrest George, and he splits. He leaves the country and disappears, whether he went to Mexico or Hawaii, we're not sure initially. And basically, this is all happening at the same time Parker and Thad Brown are fighting to become the next chief of police. This is April, May of 1950. So you have to understand the history of L.A. You have to understand the politics of the day to understand what was happening. And as I see it, basically, Parker and Brown made a management decision, sort of a Machiavellian decision. Kind of like Machiavellian princes saying, well, okay, we can expose this. We can let the public know. That'll take us out of power. The LAPD may not ever recover from it. A lot of problems. Or he's gone. We may never get him back. If we get him back, maybe Jerry Giesler will work his magic again and we'll lose the case. He knows a lot of things about a lot of different aspects of corruption. Maybe it's best to just kind of seal this off, put it away.
So, holy Toledo. So, in any event, at the end of the day, even though he was a prime suspect, he was never arraigned. There was never any preliminary hearing, anything like that. And but for your being up after he died and seeing this black picture, I mean, this picture of the Black Dahlia, and then putting together some of this other stuff, getting the newspaper articles, gleaning everything together, then it became clear that the actual murderer, no doubt about it, was your father.
No question about it. I mean, and it keeps building. We could go on and on. I mean, in the last 2 years, I've got an amazing amount of new evidence, physical evidence that connects stuff from the Franklin house to the crime scene. It just goes on and on.
And this is not the end of the story regarding your father's crimes.
No, it isn't the end. And of course, as you say, you know, they didn't have a term serial killer back in the 40s, but LAPD knew and were actively working four or five of these cases as probably being connected.
And we're going to pause one last time as you listen to today's Champions of Justice. There's a lot more to this story. Your hosts are Tom Girardi and Howard Miller. Our guest is author, private investigator, retired LAPD detective, Steve Hodell. I'm Dave Dino. Stick around. We've got more right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Dude, have you seen a video of the chimps, like, luring other chimps in? Because, you know, they eat each other.
Yeah.
They murder.
Oh.
Chimps murder.
Shocking.
The chimps, like, set traps, and they corner in, like, a couple of other chimps, and then, like, two chimps get attacked by 50.
Oof.
And they just eat them. And, like, they don't go for the neck, like, let's just get this over with.
They tear apart.
They start eating its butt while it's, like, still alive, and the thing's just like,
Dr. Drew, Midday Live, with Psycho Mike Catherwood. Weekdays, noon to 3 on KABC.
Check into Checkin' to Cash.
The cash you need today is waiting for you at Checkin' to Cash. It's your money, so come in and get it.
Get a payday advance today for up to $255.
So stop worrying and stop in to Checkin' to Cash today.
Borrowers often use payday advances over a period of months, which can be expensive. Restrictions apply. See store for details. Checkin' to Cash is licensed by the Department of Business Oversight, pursuant to the California Deferred Deposit Transaction Law.
Like the taste of fresh apples? Try an Angry Orchard Hard Cider. At Angry Orchard, we believe in tradition. That's why we use apples from a 100-year-old orchard. It takes two apples to make each bottle of Angry Orchard. So raise a glass to a time when apples were best served in a pint glass. Angry Orchard, when you're looking for something a little different. Crisp, refreshing, and not too sweet. Just like me. Angry Orchard Hard Cider. Branch out.
Angry Orchard Cider Company, Cincinnati, Ohio. Drink responsibly.
This is Judge Leo Trott. I preside in Courtroom 790. We put the news and newsmakers on trial. You provide your testimony, and together we render our verdict. Courtroom 790, the first and only interactive radio court show in America. Weekdays 10 to noon, right after Doug and T-Ray on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Talk Radio 790
KABC.
We're back for our final segment of today's Champions of Justice, hosted by Tom Girardi and Howard Miller. Our guest today is an author, a private investigator, and a retired LAPD detective, Steve Hodell. We're talking about the Black Dahlia murder. It occurred in 1947 in Los Angeles, perhaps the most infamous murder, unsolved crime, until now, in the history of the Los Angeles Police Department. Tom?
Okay, Steve, so then this thing being solved, there were a bunch of other single women who were also murdered, right?
Yes.
And those were also in the unsolved category.
That's right. They go from like 1943 to 1949, just before he leaves.
And you then started looking into some of those?
I did. And, of course, the first one was what became known as the Red Lipstick Murder, which was Jean French. A woman found beaten to death on a vacant lot, just like Elizabeth Shortbody was found, carefully posed, nude, but covered with her own clothing. And the suspect took a red lipstick and wrote it across her nude body, wrote an obscenity across her nude body. And it was basically in response to the police's basically, they were about to claim another suspect did it, and he did this to prove that they had the wrong person, and he wrote this obscenity. And that, again, the handwriting is my father's handwriting. I submitted all of this blind to a good handwriting expert, court certified, not telling her anything about the details, and she came back positive on the handwriting for both the Elizabeth Short note turning myself in and also the on the body, the lipstick on the body.
You stated that your father, in his latter years, lived in San Francisco, died in San Francisco. Of course, when we think of San Francisco, when we think of something like this, there is another serial killer name that comes to mind, and that is the Zodiac Killer.
Not only that, but some of the DA files led me into book two, which I've just which has been published out. It's been out about a year now. Most Evil, and in that I take a look at other crimes, some in Chicago that are connected, some in Manila. Manila has a Black Dahlia copycat murder that was about 2 miles from Dad's home and office, surgically bisected, posed in a lot. So in book two, I look at that. And then, of course, as you say, the Zodiac killings, while they weren't, these were couples that were basically attacked in isolated lovers' lanes, a lot of the MO is similar. Signatures, taunting of the police, mailings in. And I'm confident that I'm not claiming that those cases are solved. I do think there's a very good chance that he reinvented himself as Zodiac in the 20 years later. The handwriting has been made. There are lots and lots of connections to that. And basically,
well, did they also have the surgical signature in terms of mutilation?
No, not that. Well, he did used a large knife to stab one of his victims to death. But basically, there's a lot more than that. One of Dad's downfalls was his megalomania, his ego. And he couldn't resist that. And you'll see a lot of commonality between the Black Dahlia crime and the Zodiac crimes. I'm not saying Zodiac solved. I'm saying let's do some DNA on this. I've got my father's DNA now, and let's in or out. Very, very, very easy.
Okay. Wait, I don't get it. You're a kid. This is your dad. Here he's playing the piano. He has this background. He's smartest guy in the room, no matter what room he's in. And he's very successful as a physician. At any time, during the time that you were growing up and you were a young man and you were even a middle-aged man, did you ever think, gee whiz, maybe this guy's a bad guy?
No, that's the amazing thing. I never saw the evil. I loved some say, oh, this is a daddy dearest thing. It's not. Obviously, when you read the book, it comes out how much I love him. But basically, I never saw the evil. I saw his quirkiness. I knew he was into sex. I knew, there were these things that, oftentimes when you have that astronomical IQ, you're wired differently from us mere mortals. And basically, they have some problems in their social relationships, but never saw the evil. Always loved him. We became very close in the last decade of his life. So this to me was absolutely, for the first 2 years, I said, there's got to be some other explanation here.
In the books, do you ever go into the cause, why he would have done these?
I do. I try and look at a number of the triggers, and there's quite a few of them there. He absolutely hated his mother. She was a control freak. Mm. Probably incest in his childhood. Lots of other things that come up.
And he left the picture behind that started you on all this of the Black Dahlia. I think he did that deliberately as a clue, hoping this would be discovered?
No, I don't, because he instructed June to destroy all of his personal effects. And as fate would have it, she didn't do that. She didn't follow his last orders and gave that to me. Which, there's a lot of controversy. Is the photo her or isn't it? Which at this point no longer matters. It's all that was a catalyst to start me down the road, one of three or four.
What did you think when all of a sudden here you were very close to this person? And it'd be one thing if someone you're very close to does something wrong, runs a red light, is drunk, does something like that. Here you have this unbelievable, despicable conduct, the worst conduct any human being could ever do. What did you think? What did you say to yourself? How did I miss this?
Well, it's really been hard. I've been through every possible emotion the last 10 years since coming to the realization that this is the real deal. And, a part of me, I see him now as a Jekyll and Hyde. And I love the good part, the Dr. Jekyll. To this day, I love him. And the Mr. Hyde, the monster within, I grew to hate because of he was most evil. So I'm living with this duality and have been. And I don't see it ever changing.
What are the names of your two books?
Black Dahlia Avenger, A Genius for Murder, is the first book, and I want to be sure to get the paperback in 2006 because that's got the two new chapters with all the DA surveillance information and files. And then the recent one is Most Evil, basically the further serial killings of Dr. George Hill Hodel.
And you're working on a new one.
I'm working on the third because which will be the early years. And it's like being in this black hole that I can't get out of. And obviously he didn't wake up at age 40 and say, I think I'll be a serial killer.
Extraordinary. You know what I mean? That's all I could say. In other words, it seems to me that most of us, in knowing people, would see, you know, something when you're this bad, when you're doing these sorts of things, you know, these absurd crimes, you know, and they're crimes meant, I suppose, to laugh at law enforcement. You can't find me, and that was all part of him too.
Right, and it is amazing because you would think some of that would leak through into his daytime life. And he was he had a power, and he was very secretive, very controlling. And I think his power was staying behind the curtain like the powerful Wizard of Oz and not letting anybody see him.
Does everybody believe your book?
No. Most do. I have a very high percentage of... the trick is you got to read the book because there's so much... you can tell we just touched on a quick and dirty here... of some of the highlights, but there's a reason why it's 700 pages long, and then the 300 added to the next book, so I've got Tolstoy beat now at over 1,000 pages of investigation here, surpassing War and Peace here.
But most law enforcement people believe the story?
Yes, in fact, one of the interesting things was four of the top cops on the original case came out and actually acknowledged that they solved the case. I've got a quote from Parker. We identified the Black Dahlia suspect. He was a doctor. Got a quote from Thad Brown. The Black Dahlia case was solved. He was a doctor who lived on Franklin Avenue in Hollywood. I've got James Downey, the undersheriff, told his chief of detectives the Black Dahlia case was solved, but it'll never come out. Suspect was a doctor. They, LAPD, all knew in Hollywood, involved in abortions. Then I've got modern support from Steve Kay. LAPD Detective Chief James Murray said the case is solved. Tom Vetter from the sheriffs. It just goes on and on. So for anybody that's read the book and done a little bit of research, that's very clear that this is the real deal.
Hey, Dave Dino, we've had some stories on the show. We've never had anything like this, baby. I'm not kidding you.
This is the best.
Steve, it was really nice of you to join us. Erica has the first book, but I'm going to go get the second one right away. And it's really something, and it was nice of you to spend some time with us. I know you had some other stuff to do, and you arranged it so you could be here at this time, and it's deeply, deeply appreciated.
Oh, it's been an honor to be here and talk with you.
You have been listening to Champions of Justice with Tom Girardi and Howard Miller. Our guest today, author, private investigator, retired LAPD detective, Steve Hodel. A final thought from another author, W.H. Auden. Said this, murder is unique in that it abolishes the party it injures so that society has to take the place of the victim and on his behalf demand atonement or grant forgiveness. It is the one crime in which society has a direct interest. Well, our guest today has more than that. Our guest has a personal interest in the crime and or crimes we've talked about today. And he demands atonement for the victims. And as such, he is a champion of justice. Thank you for listening. We are